Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yo, what's up, friends?
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, that's me.
Gentlemen, we have all now seen the Joker.
Wait, has Bryce?
I haven't, but I'm also probably not running out to go see it.
Is that lack of interest just it's not your thing or just what you've heard?
It's a little 50-50 in terms of like, I don't know what this movie's about. I have lost the thread on what this movie's even about. And I kind of want to know a little bit of the premise of something when I go in to see it. And also, I don't want to feed into the things that I think are marketing stunts for the movie. So,
right on.
Yeah. But I hear it's good. Is it good? Everybody?
I liked it a lot. I was genuinely unsettled. Like, there is like an unsettling element to it. And I do think that part of the reason why it got some of the critical reaction that it got initially is because there's an element of just sort of like terror that happens not necessarily even with your main character, but with the world around it. And that to me was the movie's greatest asset. Is Todd Phillips does such a great job of demonstrating what a pile of oily rags Gotham City is and how close it is to just igniting. Like, this feels and it's something that I think a younger generation really can't remember, because I can barely remember it. It was something that had kind of been in just the generation before. But there was this idea through the 70s and early 80s that like mega cities would fall, like New York City would fall like Rome, like it would be a ruin of its former self. It would collapse on itself. And that's something that we don't really have now. Like, even cities that aren't doing great, we don't think that Detroit's just going to collapse. It still has major sports teams, right? There still are gigantic industries that run out of there. And that, there was certainly at least more of a pessimistic feeling in popular art about that idea. And this taps into that in a way that I can't remember a movie in recent times doing, where it's not a movie to me about Joker sparking a revolution. It's a movie about a dangerously a damaged sociopath who happens to kind of meet a moment in time with this collapsing city. And that to me is far more terrifying, because you can suspend your disbelief that a bunch of people would rally around a sociopath, because, you know, that's something where you could say, well, I would in this, if I were in that situation, I'd stand up and say, screw you, buddy. But if it's like the city is descending into lawlessness, it's like your only recourse is, I don't know, I guess I'd leave. If I were in that version of Gotham City, I would just try to get in my car and get the hell out, because otherwise it's the purge, right? Like it feels like just a world in which you're like, okay, yeah, that's where the purge would happen, because it's not this, the world that we live in, it's this world of like total chaos.
I think it's so apropos that you mentioned Detroit specifically, because I suspect, and I'll be interested to find out if Andrew's of the same bent as I am on this. I think RoboCop was the last of the city as hellscape movies that really resonated with me, that I believed the height of it would have been early 80s, late 70s, you know, your Taxi Drivers, your Midnight Cowboys and all that stuff. The idea that, you know, if I ever go to New York, I need a crew of armed guards around me at all times, because clearly it's a living hellscape. And to some extent, the numbers back it up. This is before we started to see this amazing reduction in murders in the early 90s that befuddled social scientists. But like, I think, Andrew, we talked about the nostalgia for the 60s and the technical achievement of bringing it alive in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That movie did not resonate with me in a powerful way, but this one absolutely did. What Justin is describing as the city as a character, right down to all of the cars, it felt straight out of Blues Brothers what was the... I can't remember a few of the other ones, but there's any number of 80s urban downtown. I'm just a gritty street cop trying to deal with, you know, crime at every corner. That came alive in a way that I haven't experienced since I was a kid. And that is one of my favorite aspects of Joker.
If you grew up watching like TV in the 70s and early 80s, everything I know about New York, I learned from like the opening credits of Welcome Back, Kotter, right? You know, where you're watching grimy subways, all this sort of stuff. And even you'd watch shows that were shot in New York, like Electric Company or things like this. You'd sort of see this very, very grimy New York. And which, not to pick on New York, big cities, but that was sort of my impression of that. And then you watch 70s movies and stuff and you see that. And I think that it absolutely captured what we remember the big cities, the dirty big cities to sort of look like. And I thought it did a wonderful job of that. And, you know, you go back and you watch movies like Midnight Cowboy or other stuff that, you know, are set like with grimy Times Square and just really seedy stuff, Panic in Needle Park. And, you know, it really was a very, very, the setting was wonderfully reminiscent of all of that. And then back when they made those movies, they weren't set dressing. They just shot New York. Yeah. And you got that look here. You know, Todd Phillips went out of his way to create this sort of environment, which, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, and I get, you know, for you, like with, you know, Once Upon a Hollywood, the long takes and just trying to make the city a character in a much longer way can try other people's patience. And I understand that. And I think here it was done in, he walks from point A to point B, you notice things, you know, you notice, and it's never, let's just stop and look at how dirty the city is or whatever.
It was a nonstop contest of trying to see like, oh my God, porno theater. What does that sign say?
Oh, because you look at the names of the pornos and some of them are like, I don't know if they're made up or what, but like Ace in the Hole was my favorite name of a porno movie you saw there. That was, you know, they had a lot of fun with that, the art direction that is fantastic. So I'm going to say the movie was great. Loved it. And I had a friend who on social media is like, oh, you know, you need to, you know, was pointing out, you know, I'm Not Really Here or whatever. Like, oh, that's the real, you know, outsider movie. That's really the better. I'm like, this is amazing because it's a DC movie. It's a studio movie and it's getting seen by a huge audience, which in itself, that it gets to exist is amazing. And yes, there are better movies out there. Okay. There are better movies that maybe handle similar topics out there, but none that are getting, they're able to thread the needle and make it into being as widespread as this. And, you know, my takeaway from it, like, is people, a lot of people talk about the themes, what they think the themes are. So let's go to that. Let's each do our sort of take on what we took away as the themes on it.
This was, if I say like an inverted hero's journey, that's going to imply.
Wait, spoiler alert, Ryan, didn't interrupt you, but just everybody knows we might be spoiling.
Yeah. So yeah, now we're in spoiler territory. So, if you think of this as, think of the traditional hero's journey, right? You got act one, begins with somebody at a place of comfort or at least balance. He goes into a different world. Things are at its worst. And then he realizes, oh my God, Neo, I'm the one. And then, you know, he's realized as a hero or whatever. Because this is an anti-hero story, you can't really play the value of good versus evil. But instead, what I got is tension about, it's almost the story of my tension as an audience member, because they do such a good job of tugging at my heartstrings and making Joker relatable for the majority of the movie, that it's only like, in a weird way, there's a tantric release after what, 70 minutes of confusion, 80 minutes of confusion and tension of like, ah, I want him to, but, and then there's one specific scene, I guess we could talk spoilers, when he kills his mom, that is a big old press release that is like, guess what? Starting right now, you no longer have to relate to him as a person. You no longer have to regard that this is any way a proxy of you or your values. This is a monster. He's a beast. He's a bad man. And you're going to see, you know, the ecstasy of what happens when the Joker realizes he's the Joker. That is an astonishingly bold take for a DC movie. How did a DC movie become my second? Like, honestly, next to Logan, I think this is the best comic book movie out there as a standalone affair.
I would say that, yeah, for me, I would say that the turn became in the subway when he chased down the third guy and he didn't have to kill him and he killed him. You know, for me, I thought
he did because that guy could identify him. He had yeah, to tie up loose ends.
Well, it was, you know, apparently our witness was a I understand the motivation of like, but also it's the evil act to cover up the outside act.
Because also it becomes a murder then as opposed to him having a general defense that it's self-defense. Like for the two guys in the subway that he pulls the gun on, they're beating him and they're drunk, right? Right. So it's like on some level you can say that maybe even if he did it with extreme prejudice, he feared for his life. And he took action. Whether or not he should have a gun is the different story. But when he chases the guy down, you're right, Brian, that he does need to tie up loose ends because now he's committing a crime and he knows he's committing a crime. So he needs to make sure that this guy cannot, you know, say anything about him.
Yeah, that's the reason. And I'm saying that, but as the moral, he made the moral chase when he's no longer under threat to murder somebody because, and that's, you know, I don't know. Rules in Texas are different, so I understand. I know.
Stand your ground. Also, your ground is as fast as you can run.
Yeah. But I like it because of those issues, because it's a complex sort of thing. The turning points are there. I didn't see the killing the mom coming. You know, when I watched the trailer, you know, the movie in my head was going to be, he gets beat up by society, gets picked upon, and then, you know, somebody does some cruel thing, and his mom gets killed, and now he lost his mom. And it's like, no. it's so much better than that, I thought. I'm going to say my takeaway themes from this, because I know there's so many people trying to project or say whatever, not to say they're wrong, is I look at this, my summation of the movie was broken people and broken systems lead to bad things. We know that he had problems because there's a point where, you know, the guy gives him a gun and he says, I'm not supposed to have a gun. And we know, and there, if you're paying attention, you're like, oh, they take away guns from you if you're kind of violent, a threat to yourself or threat to other people. So like, we know he was in the mental hospital and Arkham seems to harbor a lot of like violently crazy people and whatnot. And so like he's damaged. There's something really broken. There's a reason why he has to see a state, you know, or city appointed counselor, etc. There are all these little clues there to go that he probably had a violent, besides his childhood, he may have had a violent, he's had a violent past. And I liked it because one of the problems is that when somebody does something horrible, we often kind of go to either one conclusion, that, well, just randomly one person's going to pop and that's just the way it is. And if they have, you know, and if they have access to guns, then it'll be worse. Or, you know, it's just, I don't know. I mean, we tend to go for binary sort of things. It's either this or that. And I kind of think that like, no, I think there are really damaged people out there. And I think that if we don't address it early on, then it becomes more problematic. And I think some of our worst shootings have been mass shootings have been people who are like, the flags were there. People knew. We just didn't know how to handle people like this.
Yeah. I mean, I would echo that, thematically. I think that this is obviously, this is a story about mental health. This is a story about, you know, the unfolding elements as the movie goes on is not you discovering, like you continue to get two things on a steady pace and increasing in their impact. People that are being mean, cruel, or mean and cruel to the main character. Although it's affected by the second steady revelations of exactly where is this mental state. Like, you know that he's kind of an unreliable narrator. You get more elements of that as you go forward. And then that moment when you realize, oh, wait, the reason why he is creating these gaps in his memory is because he's blocking out this horrifying element of his childhood. And it colors the whole beginning of the movie when you're like, oh, okay, is this, you know, his mom's, you know, certainly getting old. There's a reason why she's just sitting in the house and he's taking care of her. But also, like, she has this pipe dream that Thomas Wayne is going to take care of him. And then you, like, realize, like, oh, wait, like, God, how far did they have to get as people to, from the point where they both knew, they both know the whole story, right? And it's just that they're so damaged mentally that we are now, it's only a revelation to us because we jumped in at this very specific point in the story. You know, just, I don't know. I thought it was just awesome the way that continued to sort of unfold. And you certainly feel for him even as things are getting to their darkest, because on a certain level, you're like, okay, well, you obviously have agency because you're doing these things, but also it's like, you are just dealing with a lot. Like, there's so much going on for this character.
Oh, I was gonna ask to everybody, did you mind the fact that it's quote unquote just a remix of Taxi Driver and Fight Club and yes, all those movies. Personally, I loved all of that. Like, if you go back on the second viewing, I double checked every single time they do the Fight Club thing, it very intentionally, I assume, adopt the Fight Club palette, the color palette of Fight Club. Like, to me, it's the difference of like, oh, DJ, you're just playing other people's music. It's like, no, you're combining other people's music in new and inventive ways. And I felt like that's a bit of what we got out of Joker.
I mean, to me, the biggest source materials are some of those. Like Killing Joke, the comic, and damn it, I can't remember the other solo Joker comic that people always look at as like kind of canonical to that character. But the fact that he's an unreliable narrator is kind of baked into that character, at least the source material they pulled from. So I didn't necessarily view it as a Fight Club thing specifically. And, you know, once we get to the end of that arc and you realize, like, oh, no, wait, like, we certainly see a lot of this character without her child, you know, like that's a gigantic tell, is that all the elements of Zazie Bates, that's not real. She's not with the kid, you know? And then when we see her, you realize, like, yeah, to the point where she's kind of cruel and weird when he's spending time with her as a kind of figment of his imagination. And you're like, oh, wow, I guess she's just kind of a mean person. It's probably why she's neglecting her kid, because we never really see her with the kid when they're hanging out. And then it's like, oh, no, wait, this is his. This is an extension of his psyche.
Yeah, I certainly think that, you know, we will look at the movies that we're familiar with to say, I think I've seen this there or there. But I if I were to say, oh, here's my palette of movies that I think this is drawn from, it's include some of those and a lot of different ones. And it would ultimately, we'd have to ask Todd Phillips, because, like, when I think about, like, you know, the big twist in Fight Club, it's more about, you know, multiple personality disorder and the not so much delusional sort of, you know, the idea of other people. Cause remember, that was the twist in
Six
Beautiful
Sense.
Mind too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, of the imagine, which is, there's a lot of precedent for that, of like the delusional person. We realize that they never existed in this Twilight Zone episodes, Outer Limits. And I don't know if they did I think that there is certainly a David Fincher sort of grimy sort of look that can relate to that. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
What specifically, not just the background stuff, but like specifically the light blue color palette that Fight Club was one of the vanguards to sort of establish that, like, if something is amiss, something's afoot, then, you know, this is the color palette that will be associated with that. So I felt like all of that was intentionally spoken to. Plus also, for me, and again, not that it's a contest, but given that the introduction and his first interactions with the neighbor happened shortly after what is clearly a fantasy sequence of him going in a daydream of what it would be like to be called out and brought up on stage on the What's His Name show. It was close enough that I'm like, oh, I get it. This is not really happening. This is too perfect. It's too on the nose. So, but strangely, it took nothing away from the story to perceive that none of this is real. And yet it was still amazing, right? And even the reveal didn't play as a, oh, did we get you? It played as, yeah, that didn't happen. At some point, you either figured it out or you're figuring it out right now. In either case, the bigger, more interesting story is this psycho going nuts.
Yeah, it's like, asterisk, remember, this guy's crazy. In case you forgot, this guy's crazy. And I think that, you know, I love, like, I mean, like, Scorsese's King of Comedy, which, you know, like, ah, new people are like, ah, it's a rip-off. I'm like, no, it's not. It's there is elements that are similar, but it's not that movie. And that's the thing is once we start saying, well, it's this movie and it's this movie, it's like, well, that sounds like a different movie because we've taken two different movies and combined them. And
right. This is why I'm thinking of the DJ set, because there's even an analog to the Taxi Driver You Talking to Me scene where he's dancing in his underwear, playing with the gun. And then in this case, it goes in a different direction. It goes off and he's surprised and tries to cover it up. but meanwhile, even thinking, whether you assume all of these are intentional homages or whether they're, it's delightful either way. If they are intentional, then great. If they're not intentional, what wonderful kismet.
Yeah, because I think that ultimately the story is a different one than those other stories. You know, that's the thing, is the plot of this is, and I think in that scene, I think that was absolutely a nod, you know, to Taxi Driver. And I think, you know, Phillips is conscious of that, of course, now, given Scorsese's comments. It's like, all right. I love the way it all came together. And often too, it's like, you know, we you'll see some, you know, critics will be like, ah, it's this. It's like, show me your favorite movie and I will tell you what influenced it. And then we can decide if that's good or bad, that it had an influence. The question is what is the whole story? Like, I loved it. I thought that I wanted to compare it to another movie, which I enjoyed, which was My Friend Dahmer, which was based on the comic book, based on the true story of the guy that went to a guy who went to high school with Jeffrey Dahmer, was friends with Jeffrey Dahmer. And it's about Jeffrey Dahmer, the high school years. And when you watch this movie, you know, Dahmer's not super sympathetic, but, you know, he's damaged. He needs attention. He needs help. He's not getting it because his family's messed up. And by the way, to say that somebody needs attention or help does not mean to say they're not responsible for their actions. Let me make that very clear. But there, you had a guy who became this prolific serial killer in high school, and the signs were there. The problem was that Dahmer went to high school with a guy who outwardly was even more nutty than him, and they thought that guy was going to be like the whack job serial killer. Well, Jeffrey Dahmer is literally picking up roadkill and bringing it to his shed and taking it apart and doing taxidermy and stuff and working his way up to from pets to people. But it's a good example of, let's look at a person at this phase in their life who becomes a monster, and let's examine where monsters come from. And that's not the same as saying it's okay to be a monster, but it's saying, like, no, there's more to it than just this, you know, a person's first name, middle name, last name popped and did a horrible thing.
So, quick question. There is a person who was the casting director for this, and they had to cast some characters. And the question I have for you is, when they cast the ringleader of the three Wall Street bullies in the subway, did they cast the ringleader because he happened to look a lot like Batman, Christian Bale? Or because he also kind of looked like Don Jr., President Trump's Wall Street son?
I think it was more of that 80s archetype, like the Wall Street, like, you know, everybody that Gordon Gekko hangs out with in the movie Wall Street, the slick back hair, which obviously, you know, that was why I think we were all excited when Christian Bale first got cast as Batman is because he had just done American Psycho, and you're like, oh, cool. Like, I can see the elements of what I would want a Bruce Wayne to be. But no, I mean, I would, that's what I got from it, at least. I didn't get either of those two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I when I saw that look, the first thing that hit me was the Patrick Bateman character. And then afterwards, it's like everybody reads into, like I read, you know, one person like, you know, describing, you know, Thomas Wayne is like trying to apply Trumpian or whatever. I don't know. But I'm like, sounds like Bloomberg, you know, like he fit, you know, the profile. I'm not saying he was, but like, you know, Bloomberg, you know, Wall Street, all this sort of stuff. That was his interest. And Bloomberg ran for mayor, was mayor of New York. And so, you know, I'm like, it becomes a Rorschach test, I think, for a lot of people. And without Phillips telling us explicitly what I did or not do, I think it becomes sort of a dangerous, dangerous, but it just becomes a...
Speaking of which, that's a really good point. That brings up one really fascinating question. Tom brought up a deliberate take last week on Cord Killers on this. And after he did that, Todd Phillips said some stuff that indicated that Tom might be right. Is this, quote unquote, our Joker? Is this the Joker that becomes a criminal mastermind, or is this the one-off story of one psychopath, and then 20 or 30 years later down the line, a criminal genius decides to emulate all of his stuff? Like, for example, as the equivalent, I think we talked about on a Night Attack, that it would be like somebody emulating the Columbine murders or whatever. Like 20 years after the fact, he's like, I'm Columbine man. And, because I could see it either way. Did you guys have a strong take?
Yeah, it's been floated around that you know, and the phrase I haven't heard used was the idea of Anonymous, that it's like the Joker is Gotham's version of an evil Anonymous that then, you know, 30 years later, one guy usurps it. And you have that in like the Batman mythology. You had because we're saying, where do we go next? It's like, well, we could get that period of like the other vigilantes before Batman that were even more hardcore, like I forget Black Mask or something, I forget the names of them, but there was like, or the Red Hood, I think, was one of them. And so like, you could get into that phase of before Batman of just even more lawlessness. So who knows, you know, $450 million later, is this the Joker or not? I had problems with him being the Joker because he did not have the cleverness of the Joker. But he was in this mental fog because of all these drugs and stuff. And so if we started to see glimmers of this, then it wouldn't be inconsistent to me.
I mean, I'm fine with a more brutal sort of take on that character if they wanted to go forward with it. I can probably take a wild guess that we're going to see more stories from that period of Gotham, though, because considering how much money it made. I don't know, though. I mean, I don't know which one that I would like better. I think I might in my head like better a new person that is taking their own sinister, you know, inspiration from this story that we saw, instead of like an older version of, you know, Joaquin Phoenix, you know, doing battle with the Twilight kid.
Well, I don't, but that assumes they're going to be in the same universe.
Oh, sure. I mean, whatever. I mean, I would just use the you know, fill in whoever he would match wits with in a story where that Batman was, where he was going up against Batman.
Yeah, I just remember that most of the Batmans, or most of the Jokers, have been a lot older than Batman, from, you know, Jack Nicholson to, was it like Sid Caesar, whoever, Caesar, the guy, not Sid Caesar, but the guy who played him in the TV series and stuff. So,
yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
No, I was saying an older Joaquin Phoenix, if they were going to do a thing where Batman is of, you know, in his mid 20s, then
yeah. So
20 years older.
The movie's made so much money, and it's still going, that a sequel seems inevitable, which means we're gonna want Joaquin Phoenix in there. We're gonna want the next chapter of this. So the ending, I loved, like, sometimes ambiguity drives me nuts, because it's just like, art, all right, in your face is here. I thought it was perfect, because I'm like, yeah, he doesn't know what's real. We're going to leave you going, what's real? I thought that was a perfect use of it. But it does mean now, for a sequel, well, got to figure out what's real and what's not, or what happens next. So any thoughts? What you want?
It might be interesting to withhold the Joker from us for the entire first act and instead ground us, like, just as this movie did a really good job of establishing a dreamlike quality where there were some things we thought we were sure of and then we weren't sure and so on. What if the first act we hold back the Joker, maybe, oh, this guy escaped from Gotham or whatever, and then make it very, very concrete and then let him show up as some kind of essentially a wizard to take us on a wild ride and bring back to us the idea that we don't know what's real and what's not. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any idea of how you would incorporate? I mean, Andrew, would you bring in, would the next movie be a Batman Joker story, or would you mine the world of the Joker more pre-Batman?
I think you could go. I would go let Matthew Vaughn do his Batman. I think that's great. I think that you could do, and the TV show Gotham, which I watched a few episodes in, but seemed pretty fun, shows you in this environment, there's such a neat, neat sort of, world, or horrifying sort of world there. So I think that I would like to see the idea of how we take this crazy, unstable, sign spinner guy and make him into a criminal mastermind. How does that happen? How does this guy who seemed, you looked at his journal and it was incoherent and he looked like, something a 9-year-old would write. How does he go to becoming somebody who can outsmart the world's greatest detective?
Well, and I think you tapped on it where you reveal the fact that he spent the majority of his adult life in a drug-induced fog and only now are things clear to him. But the one thing he holds on to from that time is that the destination need be chaos. Like how we get there, there's all these threads that you do A and then B and then C, but then that leads to the bliss, which is when you don't know what happens next when everybody's setting fire to everything.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was so interesting was that, Ledger's Joker was wonderful in Dark Knight. And part of that was the multiple explanations for his backstory. I loved that because it was this idea of like, oh, what if we don't know? Maybe not knowing makes it a more interesting character. But here we have a movie that just ran right in the face of that, said, no, we're going to give you a backstory on this guy. And it's not going to be, not the most, convoluted, insane, over the top, he was a billionaire, owner of, a cable comedy channel, whatever. It was just this, sad guy who horrific upbringing becomes this guy. And I kind of like that idea that he just really came from nothing, was sort of a neat take on that. So I think following that forward, though, is like I could see you could do a Joker series where it's he could go up against other vigilantes, like I mentioned before, because Gotham is supposed to have this history of vigilantes that were really over the top, too violent, edgy, and it's hard to draw the line where the heroes are not. So that could be interesting.
Did we ever talk about have you guys seen this Tom Waits interview? Speaking of the Heath Ledger Joker, did you guys happen to see this? I'll go ahead and pop.
This was popular around when that movie came out. Right?
Yeah,
when
yeah. No, it. I missed it at the time. I hadn't seen it. I just wanted to know if Andrew had seen it as well. Did you ever see this Tom Waits interview that is thought to have inspired Heath Ledger's Joker?
No.
Oh, no, it's great. We'll just look at a few seconds of it.
I want to check until you're settled in, that's all.
I'm going to get comfortable here.
Okay. How long? Nice shot. It's okay. Story, mate. We all miss once in a while. How long have you been here in Australia now?
I got here last night. I was on the plane from Paris for about 22 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fascinating flight.
What do you do for 22 hours on a flight? You have ways of entertaining yourself?
Well, they show movies that are not a big success anywhere else. They put them on the planes.
You want these? This is what you're looking for?
Thank you.
So everything from the fidgeting to the voice affectation, and the constantly, in this case, he's constantly grabbing cigarettes. I don't know if you smoked in The Dark Knight, but it's one of those things where Jason Murphy showed this to me saying, hey, I'm going to show you an interview. And at some point it might occur to you that it's similar to something else. And then I started watching it. It's just like a wave. You suddenly see it. It's really great. Just look for Tom Waits interview Joker. You should be able to find it.
I believe it. I mean, I think Ledger was, you know, was an amazing actor, and I could see him in the conversations. The only thing I remember, like, him and Nolan, they said was like the voice should be kind of like a ventriloquist or sing song sort of voice kind of thing. But you watch that and you're like, yeah, this feels like, it's like watching David Copperfield specials, then watching like Donnie and Marie specials, and you realize, or whatever John Travolta was wearing at the time, you're like, oh, this is where David Copperfield got his clothing choices from. Now I know, you know. Would, you know, first it was Donny Osmond, then it was Travolta. You know, that was the pattern. So I if you're listening this far and you haven't seen it, I recommend you see it. Like, we're going to probably go see it again. And, you know, everybody's take is their own. If it's not for you, it's fine. You know, but I think that people, the hesitancy, maybe on part of Bryce, is there is this sort of, oh, it means this, it means that, it means this. And I really think it's a movie that, I actually think it's kind of I think it's really apolitical, to be honest with you. Cause like, I don't walk away going and like, therefore this party's right or this party's wrong.
Well, hey, Bryce happens to be here. Bryce, is that your feeling?
I can see if other people who are not interested in the movie kind of having that thing. For me, I just want to be unsubscribed from the whole narrative of it. It's like a superhero origin movie. I don't know. Maybe I'll watch it when it's streaming, but I don't want to invest in it emotionally, because it sounds like of all the stupid crap I get emotionally invested in, it may not be the top of the list. But
I totally agree. I think that it is your right to sit it out, but it is worth seeing. I think at a certain point when watching a movie and having your opinion is not a thing that people should be following you or unfollowing you about. Like, you know, it is worth checking out.
Yeah. If I'm looking at the new Regal Pass. If I end up getting that and Joker is still out, maybe I'll do it. But, yeah. I will say, I totally get that people will have that.
Hey, a real quick Joker thing before we wrap up. Todd Phillips, obviously director of The Hangover and a bunch of other comedy stuff, old school. There is something about comedic directors that you see when they do drama. In the best examples, comedy is all about communication, right? A lot of times in drama, a scene can be a little wishy-washy and it matters more because you're reading your exact emotions into how these people are feeling. Comedy, you don't have that luxury. Like, you have to slip on the pie and fall right on your butt, or else it's not as funny as it would be otherwise. And there are two scenes that, to me, exemplify Todd Phillips visually and emotionally as a comedic director being very clear to the point where it is heartbreaking or terrifying. And the two scenes are in the children's hospital with the gun, which is a pivotal moment in the story. And then probably the greatest moment of tension in the movie is after he has already done something horrifying, there is another little person in the room and realizing that you have no idea where this is going to go and whether or not they're, he's going to do something horrible to him. But then the sight gag that happens right after there, where it's like, it's funny ? If it weren't like literally horrifying, like it is almost the definition of a sick, cruel joke. But I just wanted to single those out as just amazing moments in the movie.
For me, it definitely held up to a second viewing. What I suspect I will not see again is my reverse pick of, I watched El Camino last night. Or Footnotes, really? The movie. I mean, so it was a series of 5 to 10 minute vignettes, each of which filled in a backstory that nobody was asking for. Each one well crafted and well executed, and it was fun to see certain people appear again. But ultimately, the movie answers a question that nobody had.
Yeah, I walked away from it feeling that same thing. I did enjoy it, but I did go, that movie didn't justify its existence. I think there's very cool stuff. I think the intrigue, that there's some drama, there's some thrill. It is, we see some of the same people. Apparently the actor, the identity actor guy with the vacuum shop, apparently he died like the day it came out or the day
before it
came out.
You said identity. Oh, the, got it. That,
oh,
yeah.
Robert Forrester. Yeah.
Right. Oh. Right. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's like, oh yeah, this is exact. I mean, you watch that opening scene with him and Mike, and you're like, oh, okay, so that's, I know exactly how it's going to end. There's not going to be any mystery or drama around that part of the film. And so, yeah, it doesn't justify it. It's finely made.
I mean, and written and directed by Vince Gilligan. And so it's fun to, look, there are certain people, you don't really care if they have a good story or a bad story. You just want to hang out with them. It was great to hang out with everybody involved in that. It was great across the board. Did it merit going to the movie theater instead of just waiting a few more days for it to be on Netflix? Also, is it on Netflix?
Yeah, it's a day and date.
Okay, so it
was
day
and date.
Did you
go to the theater?
I did.
How was it watching it in the theater?
Well, the whole reason I went to the theater is like, man, how much fun will it be to be like surrounded with other people who are fans? And I have to assume the one other guy also had a podcast that he was reviewing it for. Because, I mean, well, granted, maybe more people were supposed to come. I did buy my ticket 20 minutes before the movie.
Bryce, you did your pick?
No, you know what? Mr. Robot. Mr. Robot's back, and it's in the final season, and I don't know that we're at full speed yet. I don't think we've gotten all the way up to fourth or fifth gear, but I think it's still intriguing. We're starting to really wrap up a lot of the long, confusing threads from that story. This last episode was nice and had one big data point in it, and I think sometimes that's enough. But I don't know. Brian, did you watch Mr. Robot last night?
I have not seen the new one. I got caught up. What's funny is I did all my prep as if Cord Killers was today, and then remembered that it wasn't.
We're off this week. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really highly recommend it. I think Mr. Robot on the USA Network.
My pick is going to be the Frank Miller comic book series, The Dark Knight Returns, which came back out in 1986, which I loved back then. I remember waiting for each issue of this to come out, and the smell of the paper was exciting. And it is, as far as influencing incarnations, like every incarnation of Batman has since then has drawn something from there, even the Schumacher Batman stuff, you know, elements of that. And I guess Schumacher wanted to try to make this into a movie at one point. But I thought, you watch Joker and there's you watch this and I'm seeing the panels from Dark Knight Returns where, you know, it's the David Endicrine show with the Ruth Westheimer character. And it's very much borrows elements from there like that. And so I think, you know, go back and read that. And it's a wonderful, wonderful, I think, example of Batman storytelling. The idea is it takes place after Batman had retired. And, you know, he was the old age of 55, which doesn't sound so old now. But I love that comic run. I think it's one of the best, you know, you get it as a graphic novel, one of the best ever. And I think it's been influential so much from, you know, Nolan to Phillips now. And everybody has sort of drawn so much from that. Snyder, et cetera. So, just one of my favorites of all time. So,
nice.
Yeah, total cosign on that.
Yeah, cool. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.